This is a special Caucus Day edition of Talk of Iowa, a joint venture between Iowa Public Radio and Minnesota Public Radio, recorded last evening at the Iowa State Historical Building in Des Moines. Iowa Public Radio's Jonathan All and Minnesota Public Radio's Carrie Miller anchored discussion featuring complete caucus analysis. Their guests, political scientist Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa and Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa. Also joining the conversation, Doug Gross, former chair of the Mitt Romney campaign back in 2008. All of the discussion is next after news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown.
This is a special Caucus Day edition of Talk of Iowa, a joint venture between Iowa Public Radio and Minnesota Public Radio. Recorded last evening at the Iowa State Historical Building in Des Moines, Iowa Public Radio's Jonathan All and Minnesota Public Radio's Carrie Miller anchor discussion featuring complete caucus analysis. Their guests, political scientist Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa and Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa, and Doug Gross, former chair of the Mitt Romney campaign back in 2008. To start the program, Kerry Miller asked Doug Gross why true transformative political leadership is so rare.
Finding a politician who can both capture the imagination of the American people and then lead them to a place where they're not already going is very, very difficult, particularly in our current environment, because today we're so divided. The parties have a totally different worldview, particularly as it relates to government and the role of government. And I think in the 2012 general election, we're going to see a diametrically opposed set of candidates, the Republican and the Democrat, associated with that question. What role should government play right now in the history of our country? There's a very, very different approaches.
But you said something interesting there where you said both capture the imagination of the American people and then lead them where they want to go. Why where they want to go? Isn't true political leadership to inspire Americans perhaps to be led to a direction they didn't necessarily know they wanted to go in?
I think you may have misheard me a bit. I said both capture their imagination and lead them to a place that they wouldn't otherwise
I
go.
I see.
That's what leadership does, is it identifies obstacles and opportunities before an entity or a country in this case, and helps people achieve or obtain those or avoid those when left to their own devices they wouldn't. My definition of politics is to make something happen that wouldn't otherwise happen on its own, and these are political leaders. So the question is, can they make something happen that wouldn't otherwise happen on its own? Ronald Reagan was a transformative leader because he captured the imagination of the American people and then led them to a different view and approach for government than we'd had before. FDR was a transformative leader because he captured the imagination and soothed the fears of Americans at a critical time and then developed a system of government, a role of government in our country we hadn't seen before in our history.
So, Donna, Doug has named two figures who often come up when we talk about transformative political leadership, but they are names, as I said, that often come up. Why are they all names that we know, and why does this seem to be in somewhat short supply?
Well, I think the two presidents that Doug mentioned are good examples of leadership. Leadership is one of those things that it's very difficult to define it. It's kind of one of those things, you know it when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just leadership. Other conditions, you can have people who have the capacity or the ability to lead, but you also have to have contextual environmental factors in the political environment be right.
And what would those
for
be?
Those kinds of things to happen? You see, in political science terms, we often talk about realignments where voters move to one party or another, and those have become very, very rare and probably can't even happen in this environment that we have now. But you have a person put out a vision that people flock to. In droves, you saw it with the New Deal realignment. You saw it with Reagan to some degree, that they present a picture and people follow. And that's the notion of leadership, is that they give you a vision, and they show how it's potentially possible to get there. And that's very, very difficult to do. And one of the problems that we have in today's political environment is partisanship is extremely problematic. And so I think you saw with Barack Obama somebody who had potential leadership abilities, and he's been given a really difficult task because expectations of him were extraordinarily high, and campaigning is very different from governing. And he's had difficulties governing because of partisanship to a large degree, and to a larger degree than even some previous administrations have had. Partisanship is really a different dynamic than we've seen historically in some ways right now.
So, Tim, I was reading about this, and I happened on to James McGregor Burns, who has talked about transactional leadership and transformational leadership. And one of the ways that he defines transformational leadership is joining the purpose of many disconnected or conflicted individuals for an elevated purpose. Talk to me a bit about whether we are in, I think I hear Donna saying that we're not in an atmosphere right now where that's very likely. Do you believe that for as much as Americans say they want change, they want that kind of transformation?
I think they do, but it goes back to what Doug was saying in the sense that you find those opportunities, and every president faces challenges. Some face greater challenges than others, and you may have, as Donna was saying, the president that maybe has those skills but doesn't have the opportunities. Mm-hmm. One of the things I had heard, and I don't remember who first made the comment, but supposedly President Clinton was very unhappy that he didn't have that opportunity to really demonstrate his abilities, that he certainly reached across the aisle, did a number of things, got legislation passed, but he didn't really have that really golden opportunity to become the great president that he believed he could become under those circumstances, where you find somebody like FDR, who of course had the Depression, World War II, and even Reagan with the Cold War and the situation the country was in coming off terrible economic times, that they took those difficult situations. We had a lot of partisanship, particularly post-Watergate and the several years afterwards, so Reagan had to pull people together. And I think even the next president has an opportunity to get past the partisanship, that we've reached a point in economics, world situation, that you can perhaps find that common ground and build on that common ground in a way to bring people together and basically succeed.
I'm going to come back to the past the partisanship part of that in just a minute, but I think you've pointed out the paradox of the situation that President Obama found himself in. You say that Iowa Republicans view President Obama as a weak leader. He seemed to indicate as a candidate that he thought he could be a transformational leader, has turned out in the view of many Republicans to be a weak leader, and yet they have done, I think you've said this, just about everything they can to prevent him from actually leading.
I wouldn't phrase it quite that way. What the Republicans in general, and of course not specific to Iowa Republicans, but they don't like his policies. And what Obama has not found a way to do yet, and we'll see if he gets a second term, if he finds a way beyond the first term, is to bring people from the other side to the table. That rather than find that common ground and work on that common ground, he's taken a more doctrinaire position on a number of issues. And we're seeing this even recently with a number of his, what of course Republicans accuse him of, class warfare. And so of course raising taxes, for example, is anathema to Republicans. And he hasn't been able to find that common ground. And that's kind of back to where you see that he was a great campaigner. He thought he could do a lot of things, but when you get to the nitty-gritty, we get to actually governing, it's a different skill set, and he wasn't really ready for it, or at least ready for the opposition that he would have to deal with when he became president.
Go ahead.
I think Tim makes an interesting point about Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and that Bill Clinton was a president with great ability that couldn't find a crisis, while Barack Obama has more crises than he can handle but didn't have the ability to handle them. He simply wasn't prepared. I don't know if you've had a chance to read Ron Susskind's book, The Confidence Man.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear that he was not prepared with his background to put together a team, an organization, a process to deal with what he was left with when he became president of the United States. I think, however, we are at a point right now, and the 2012 election will give us this opportunity, that we can have transformational leadership. What transformational leadership McGregor Burns is talking about is matching motivations. disparate interests but matching motivations. And the motivations right now in our country is to restore the greatness of our country, both economically, culturally, and otherwise. There's a great yearning, a desire on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, to see that happen. And as if there can be a transformational leader at this point would match the motivation of the blue-collar worker who's been laid off by globalization with the problems that the middle manager is having about whether or not they're going to have a retirement. How do we solve those kinds of problems with innovative, interesting ideas and interesting leadership?
Well, so you feel that, I mean, when I hear you talk about that, I think of there are lots of ideas, but I cannot imagine the person that can bridge the kind of polarization that we're seeing. I mean, is it a dearth of good ideas, and that's where the connection doesn't get
No.
Doesn't get made?
I don't think there's lots of ideas out there. We have a country full of ideas. What you have to do is you have to figure out a way so that the interests of all the parties are met in a way that's innovative and creative. Now, how is that done? Well, it's done by the example a leader leads or a sets. The most important thing we do in our families with our kids is set an example for how they should live their lives. The most important thing a president of the United States does is sets an example with how we are to conduct our public policy. What I'm very concerned about right now with Barack Obama, he's decided and his team has decided that the only way they can win re-election in a down economy is by basic polarization, class warfare, as Tim calls it, where you focus on, you set up a demon, in this case the millionaires who aren't paying enough taxes, and you demonize them.
The other side has done that as well, haven't they, in the political debate?
I think for both sides it's bad. Because once you do that, you'll find that if he wins election, I think the odds are he would still win election. Once he wins election, he'll be unable to govern. Because the example he set was one of polarization, rather than the example he set is one of bringing people together. If he wanted to be a transformational leader, what he would have done after he set up the Bowles-Simpson Commission is recommended it to the Congress in its entirety and said, you know, there's a lot of stuff in here I don't like, but I'm recommending because it's the right thing to do for our country. And, you know, the Republicans wouldn't have had any choice. They'd have had to pass it.
I think we ought to go out into the audience now. Talk to me about some of the qualities of transformational leadership and what you think about what you've heard so far. Yes, sir.
Well, this is actually, I guess, more a structural issue, but I think it's something that both Republicans and Democrats have had to deal with recently, and that's the United States Senate. Ever since the filibuster has become the norm, both parties, I think, have been frustrated by passing, you know, pretty aggressive programs in the House and then having it stalled in the Senate. So I'm wondering how much a part of this problem that prevents presidents and other politicians from leading is centered directly in the U.S. Senate and the abuse of the filibuster.
Donna, can I throw
that
to you?
It is true that filibusters used to be reserved for fairly weighty, rare policy issues, and they're now routinely used. And it is a structural issue. And the Senate is unique. It prides itself on being the world's greatest deliberative body, and that is why you have the unlimited debate that makes the filibuster possible. The Senate has to grapple with that in the last several years with the nuclear option previously in the mid-2000s and more recently with some filibusters and some things going on in the Senate. They've looked at that issue. They have to come to grips with what they're going to do about it and if it makes the institution of the Senate essentially broken. A lot of people, a lot of scholars who look at Congress have even called it the broken branch. For various issues, and the filibuster is one of them, but there's even some issues with the House as well, because normal procedure oftentimes is not used for a lot of things, and it's a function of the desire of Congress to get something done and some of the structural impediments that are there, like the filibuster, but some other things as well. So that's something really that Congress has to grapple. But, you know, the American public can play a role here as well because, you know, we... Congress's approval rating is what, 9%, maybe low single digits, and it's not going anywhere. And yet we reelect incumbents at very high rates because it's never our Congressperson that's the problem; it's the institution of Congress that's the problem. And the institution of Congress really is going to have to grapple with the dissatisfaction that the American public feels towards it. And they're not quite to that point yet.
So, Jonathan, let me come to you, and then we can get back to the audience here. That dissatisfaction gives rise to the desire for more change. When Iowans talk to you about change, tell me what you think they mean.
Well, I think there's two different answers to that. I think that and it's probably a reflection of the country in general, there are those people that believe that the change that needs to happen is compromise. They look at why Republicans and Democrats can't get together and agree that neither side is going to get 100% of what they want, but stop rolling up proposals in poison pills that they know the other side will reject, that they'll stop doing those kinds of things, and that they'll really look at some kind of bipartisanship, some give and take, and some compromise. The other side is the ideologues that believe that their side is not going far enough to go to these ultimate ideals. So I think when you look at the role of the Tea Party in Iowa or the Occupy Iowa movement, what you're seeing is the dissatisfaction from the polls, believing that their leaders aren't doing enough to that ideological extreme. And then you also have frustration from the people in the middle that say, well, don't just stand there, do something. And I think that you're getting two very distinct different kinds of frustration, and I think that's one of the things that has made this caucus season so very interesting, is that there's a lot of frustration, but there's no commonality in where that frustration's coming from.
So to come out to the audience and to build on what Jonathan has just said and to pick up on what Doug said about the kind of leader that bridges these competing interests of the parties, what are the qualities that leader would have to have? Will somebody weigh in on that? Characteristics, qualities?
I don't think it so much matters who the leader is yet at this point. Because nothing is happening in Congress. I think a big part of that is the gerrymandered districts, is that it's not really truly representative of, you know, the population. Because we have all these safe districts around the country so that people can get away with casting votes however they feel. Luckily here in state, in Iowa, we have an independent commission, but if all the states would adopt that, I think we would see a Congress that was much more fluid and would more accurately represent what the people wanted.
Let me follow up on that, though. If that was the case, do you think that there would be even more push for members of Congress to try to get credit for all the good and be able to push the blame to somebody else if their districts were even less safe than they are right now?
There might be more, push on them, but there would also be more accountability, I think, too, because they'd have to deal with all different types of voters. And so I really don't see a negative to having all the states move to independent commissions for redistricting.
Doug?
Now, the problem you have today with the gerrymandering that occurs in a number of our states is that you have districts where the incumbents are safe, or alternatively, any one member of the party is safe. So as a result, the only thing they worry about is a primary challenge. And if the only thing you worry about is a primary challenge, you've got to worry about the extreme part of the base, whether it's the right or the left wing. And in Iowa, where you have districts that are based upon population and compactness, you've got to worry about all parts of the base, both right and left. As a result, you're going to have more moderate candidates, and I think that's a perceptive point. But we need to understand, too, I think, that we've always had politics in our country. We've always had partisanship in our country. My gosh, you mean Hamilton and Burr were on the plains in New Jersey, and one of them shot the other one over political issues. I mean, this was serious politics. What we're faced with, I think, in many respects right now, is the fact that our system is set up for an inefficient government, a relatively ineffective government. Our founding fathers wanted the Senate to be a chokehold on easy public policy or the whims of the populace that were reflected in the House of Representatives. They wanted that. They set it up that way. Yet at the same time, the demands of our society and our world today demand a government that can deal with some vexing problems in a relatively efficient way, i.e. debt. And what we've done in our country and in the world in the last few years is we've transferred excessive private debt to government debt. And now we're saying government figure out how to deal with it. And the markets are relying on the government to deal with it effectively when they're set up in a system that makes it totally impossible to do so. I mean, that's why we're faced with some real difficult issues with our country right now. But whether it's the Occupy movement or the Tea Party, you have a situation where both sides are disaffected with the current situation,
right.
And a transformative leader can deal with that disaffection in a way that brings that together. Well, I think it's possible.
And this is why I wonder about the characteristics, the qualities of that transformational leader. Sir, you had a question or a thought about that? Jonathan, up and over the seats.
It seems that the need to be reelected drives it all. That when you look at Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage, those are the types of leadership we'd all wish we could see, but none of them are going to get reelected if they do that.
Is that true?
And it seems to me that that's where the partisanship, and as Doug was saying, that when you're playing to a primary base that's extreme in some way or other, you're either going to change when you get to the general election, which gives everybody a chance to tell you that you're changing your positions and flip-flopping and all that, which, you know, changing your mind seems to be a bad thing when sometimes it's not. And we all look at that as a negative, and I don't see that necessarily true either. But people, a true leader who's going to lead from what they believe is right and not worry so much about what polls say or who's going to, you know, if I do that, am I going to get in trouble? Is the media going to jump on me? What's going to happen negatively? That seems to be the biggest concern of the politicians. It's getting reelected, which, of course, then if you're in your last term, why doesn't that still allow for leadership? We still seem to want to go out feeling the same way or something.
Answered your own question.
I can't say I understand it, but it seems to be one of the issues.
Isn't it true what we need are just effective politicians? I would argue that Bill Clinton was an incredibly effective politician. He knew how to charm both Republicans and Democrats to accomplish things that otherwise other people couldn't have accomplished, because he was very effective at manipulating the interests of people and matching motivations. It seems to me what we read right now is not less politics, but better politics. Politicians are better capable of reaching across the way in a way that doesn't jeopardize their reelection. I mean, think about Abraham Lincoln. Very much a politician, even as it comes to slavery. Very much nuanced with regard to slavery, so he could achieve election and then achieve victory in the Civil War without excessive polarization. But he was an effective politician in how he did so. It seems to me that's what we need now.
Tim Hagel, do you want to weigh in on what our audience members said and what Doug had to say about that?
Yeah, and I want to take it back to the first question that was asked when talking about the Senate as a chokehold. That's where that effective president can come into play. And I was sort of thinking of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who, of course, had been majority leader in the Senate, was well known as a deal maker, an arm twister, and all of that. He may not have been the most charismatic president, but he got things done. And that's what you may need to have these days, and somebody that can do those, work those deals, find those motivations, and get things done in a way that benefits the country.
That's Tim Hagel. He's a political science professor at the University of Iowa. It was part of a town hall forum last night in Des Moines, a collaboration between Iowa Public Radio and Minnesota Public Radio, hosted by Iowa Public Radio's Jonathan Aull and Minnesota Public Radio's Kerry Miller. Kerry Miller asked UNI political science professor Donna Hoffman about the idea that the current political system is not set up to reward true political courage.
Well, Doug made the point, you know, we need better politicians. We also need better citizens, perhaps, as well, because citizens need to understand, as Doug was pointing out, we do have an inefficient government. Government was made to be inefficient on purpose. We should prize that. And you will hear citizens say Congress can't get anything done, and that is true at times, but that is how the system was designed. Presidents can't unilaterally do very many things, and that is how the system was designed. And citizens need to understand that compromise is also necessary in our system of government. The Constitution was set up as a compromise document. The government that it put together functions by compromise. And when you have citizens thinking that, as the gentleman in the audience was saying, you know, sometimes you do have to change your mind, but that gets labeled as a flip-flopper in a campaign season. And so citizens need to understand what is possible in our system of government. Part of Barack Obama's problem has been these extraordinarily high expectations that he had coming into office. He couldn't do the things that people expected him to do, and nor would we want him to be able to do the things that people expected him to do in our system of government, which divides power up and makes it very difficult to wield power.
So when you put it back on the citizens, I mean, the citizens, I hear them, many of them saying they do want compromise. Are they saying that without really believing it? I mean, how should we interpret what we hear from voters on that?
Well, I mean, that's the difficult thing as a politician. You have to be able to please your constituents. Re-election is a huge motivation for members of Congress. And if you are going to compromise, you have to be able to tell your constituents why that was necessary. And a lot of constituents, I think, can respect someone who can explain why they voted the way they did, even if they don't necessarily agree with it.
What about the flip-flopper idea? I mean, when a politician changes their mind with new information or more information, is that acceptable? Why should they be subject to the flip-flopping change? Yes, sir?
What happens is that it's acceptable if they change to your point of view. And seriously,
right.
Nobody wants if they change their mind from something you agreed with to something you don't agree with, you're not going to like them. And it's just the opposite. If they change to your point, great, courageous stand.
Right.
And so this is that's sort of human nature, I think.
Jonathan, I want to ask you as a member of the media, because we, the media, play the role in repeating the flip-flopping claim or reporting on the ads that says the flip-floppers. What role do you think the media has in this?
Well, a lot of it, just what we end up doing is reflecting that which is put out there. So at some level, it's like the old line from the Pogo cartoon, "I have seen the enemy and it is us," is that ultimately, and I hear what Donna's saying, that if people get reelected to Congress, regardless of their actions, if the media reports a certain way, but people continue to consume that product, if the message that is sent out there is accepted and acted upon, ultimately, the power still rests in the hands of the people.
But see, my beef with the media on this is more context. I don't think the media ought to just be a mirror of what's out there. I think it's incumbent on us to provide the kind of context that either, you know, disavows the flip-flopping claim or enforces it.
In many respects, what's going on right now in our political discourse is people have preconceived notions, and they watch Fox if they're on the right to reinforce them, and they watch CNN or MSNBC on the left to reinforce those, and they don't want to be challenged. And so as a result, we reinforce through the media polarization. It becomes a very easy thing for the media to do, just to reinforce preconceived notions. Where there's a hunger, I think, right now within the middle of the country is for a media that forces us to think and to question our assumptions, so that sometimes it's better to flip than flop, and the media ought to say that.
Yeah.
But they never do. They never do, because they're just reacting to preconceived notions.
There's also a role here, though, for citizens, again, because never before have citizens be able to get around the media than they can at this point. If you want to know what the president said in a speech, go read the speech. You don't have to listen to the talking heads on Fox or MSNBC to find that out. You can go to the internet and you can get the speech, and you can read it for yourself and judge for yourself. But citizens are busy people. They rely on the media for sound bites and things like that. But again, it's incumbent on citizens to do the due diligence and find out the answers that they need to have.
Right up there.
Pat from Des Moines. Ask Doug to repeat himself if he really did say, "I think probably President Obama will be reelected." That's the way I feel, and I think that the discussion gets bogged down in small details. Think about the big picture. Four pretty powerful Republican governors, three in office and one who was in office and whose father was the president before him and his brother was the president before him, all of them chose not to run against President Obama, all four of them. Of the candidates that are in the field, there's relatively few, maybe one or two, that would be regarded as even possible winners in November's election. And if you stand back again and say, well, has this president actually done anything? Well, actually, I think he did do something. He passed health care. I think health care will rank with Eisenhower's interstate highway system or Lyndon Johnson's health care for senior citizens, which I am one now. Anyway, my point is, step back from it and say, does this president you know, enjoy good poll ratings? He's not out of it. Is the outcome a foregone conclusion? Not yet. But has the other side fielded their best candidates? I would say not at all.
You're a former state legislator, right?
Yes, that is correct. I served in the Iowa Senate for 24 years. And
you're
I
the
served,
only politician in the room, so I have to come to you to
I
ask you.
I served as a staff guy earlier. So, yeah.
All right, so good. So you have a really good perspective on this. To go back for a moment to what we were talking about the idea of true leadership and true political courage, I want to know how you interpreted it in your own career, how you stood up to that ethic.
In my own career, and I would say Doug Gross, to his credit, in the career he did both as a staff person and since then, you look and say, what are the needs that need to be addressed? What are the issues that are really pressing there that people need an answer to? And when you're in political office, you have access to the press, you have access to discussions, and you're out in your community, and you can identify those needs and then try to forge coalitions that address those needs.
Does that sometimes mean what Doug said earlier in leading your constituents in a place they may not want to go?
Well, absolutely. In my opinion, you identify the problem. It's not too much different from sales in the private sector, in which you're not selling the product, you're selling the need. Do you need to address this issue?
Mm-hmm.
And you work really hard to identify the problem. And then once you persuade people that you've identified a problem that should be addressed, you present some solution, and they roll it over, and you have, that's where the checks and balances come in. Everybody fights over the solution, et cetera.
Did you see yourself as a legislator or a representative? Did you believe you were there to simply advance the will of the people who elected you, or that you had some mandate to do what you thought was right?
Absolutely. You're in identifying the problem that should be addressed. You're being a leader. You're being way more than reflecting what they think should be done. And if you identify the problem that should be addressed, then people respond to that and they say things about you like, well, I don't agree with him on everything. And one guy said to me, I don't agree with you on 80% of your votes, but I do like the idea that you're thinking and trying to help us figure something out. Because, again, not unlike Barack Obama or anybody else serving in office, you can't get it done all by yourself. You can't simply say, this is the problem and this is what I've decided is the solution. Again, President Clinton, who gets a lot of credit for doing something, tried the backwards way on health care, and it didn't happen. My point would be, you got to identify the problem. Once you've gotten that discussion going in your direction, then you can get the legislature to pass a solution. And I think if President Obama is reelected, the health care thing still has 4 years to implement.
Who else in the audience here on this idea of quality of leadership, political courage? Yes, sir.
One thing that I've noticed about a good leader is that they have a way of kind of having a hunch as to what might be a decent compromise, and then being able to work towards it fairly skillfully and sell it. And they may, in negotiating, initially take a position that's maybe a little bit beyond what they actually plan to settle for, but you know, they're artful enough to understand what their eventual target is, and they can kind of steer into it somehow.
Doug, this is the second time we've heard the word selling when it comes to positions. I mean, you managed politicians' campaigns, and you were the chief of staff for the governor. How do you interpret that idea of selling?
Well, I mean, as Pat indicated, a good share of change is first to get your constituency to understand there's a problem and understand there's a common problem. and then lay out a range of solutions, some of which they think are reasonable. And that's not any different, as Pat says, than selling a product. But you need to be a skillful salesman. And a skillful salesman doesn't just sell the problem, but he sells something greater than that. The current incumbent sold hope.
Mm-hmm.
But we, in terms of defining that hope, I think it ran short. What I'm concerned about with President Obama and his leadership style, I think he has all the personal capabilities of being a transformative leader. But I think what he's doing in order to be reelected, because of the conditions he faces, is very divisive. And as a result of that, people are not going to see a range of bipartisan solutions to problems. And if he were to be reelected, he'll be faced with even greater polarization than he is today, and I think that'd be terrible for our country.
Don, I wonder if you agree with the, I think this is the second time Doug has talked about this, the divisiveness of President Obama's approach.
I don't think I agree totally. Obama came into office with a Democratic Congress and was able to do lots of things. If you look at the bills that were passed in that Congress, it's surpassed recently only by one of the Congresses that Lyndon Johnson had. So they were they did a lot of things. Now, everybody in the country didn't agree with those things, and that's part of what you had happening, I think, in 2010. But the economy plays a very large role here. People are dissatisfied with the economy, and that colors a lot of things and a lot of perceptions that they have. And so Obama has come under fire from his left flank for being too willing to compromise,
mm-hmm.
For selling out on the public option, for example, on health care reform. And he has, one of the interesting things about Obama is he's come under a lot of attack and unwillingness to compromise from Republicans because, Mitch McConnell said we want to make him a one-term president. Attacks on his citizenship have been particularly problematic, I think. And so Obama is, and lots of presidents get into this position where they, because you're president of the entire country, you're not president of the Democrats, you're not president of the Republicans, and you do have to compromise as president, but that dissatisfies your left flank, and then an election comes along, and sometimes you have to make adjustments.
You want to respond to that?
No, I think that's a reasonable response, except for the fact that, as I said before, the most important quality of leadership is example. And anybody can do things that 80% of the people in the polls say they're for, i.e. taxing millionaires. But how does that really solve our budget problems? It doesn't. And what people really want in the middle are somebody who's going to solve our problems. And so the president needs to lead with some things that people don't necessarily think are going to think are 80% issues in the polls. And if he does that, he'll find that he'll have more people follow.
If I can follow up
yes.
on that, one of the things that, as Donna pointed out, when President Obama had the Democratic Congress, he was able to get some things done. And they may turn out to be great things in terms of health care. We have to wait and see how that all shakes out. But given, as Donna also indicated, the reaction in 2010, there's a difference between pushing something through and still selling it, even when you have the ability to get it done in Congress. You still have to sell it to the people. You have to get them to understand so that you don't have that big backlash. And that's been part of President Obama's problem since 2010 elections, is because of that backlash, because he didn't adequately sell his product, that he forced it on people more than he should have. Now he's in a worse position, and he can't go back to his old way of campaigning on hope and sort of that inspirational side of things, because now he has to run on a record and he's in a much tougher position, and that's where you see the approach that we're probably going to end up with for 2012, which is a much more negative campaign style.
You're listening to a Town Hall Forum in Des Moines, Iowa, a co-production of Minnesota Public Radio and Iowa Public Radio. Jonathan, you want to add anything to this?
Well, I'd be curious for the panel to address what does the electorate really expect? Because there's a great piece in The Atlantic looking at Sarah Palin's record as governor. And if you took her name off it and just looked what a Republican governor did in that state, there was a lot of compromise with Democrats. There was a lot of meeting in middle ground. There was a lot of going against what were, quote, traditional Republican positions. But when Sarah Palin received the nomination, or was chosen to be the vice presidential candidate with John McCain, she went in a completely different direction, the perception being that's what the electorate wanted. So from our panel, to what extent do you believe that the electorate is getting what they want when politicians don't go to compromise, they don't try to find the middle ground, and they stake their positions out on the extreme? Are we just simply getting what we've asked for?
Donna, jump in on that, and then Doug, if you will.
You know, I think to the American public does not, they're not all policy wonks, and so there is sometimes kind of this schizophrenic way in which they interact, I think, with politicians and on policy issues as well. And so, you know, again, to go back to that notion of compromise, it's okay. Citizens, I think, a lot of times understand at a very theoretical level that governing takes compromise, but not on the issues that I really care about. I don't want you to compromise on the issues that I really care about. And that's, you know, being a politician is very, very difficult, and that's part of the problem is, one, trying to figure out what the public wants. Is that really what they need? Because that's part of your job as a politician to do that. And then convincing, you know, also explaining your vote or explaining your policy stance. And as Tim pointed out, I think this is, you know, one of the problems that Obama has had with health care is that they did not do a very good job explaining what that meant to people. There's lots of, first of all, it's a very complex issue, lots of components of it. There's lots of smaller components of it that are extremely popular with the public, but if you ask the man on the street, wouldn't necessarily say that they know that's in the bill or in the law. And so, you know, the American public has kind of the surface knowledge of policy, and that's one of the problems that politicians have, is they have to figure out how they're going to talk to the public about what the issues are and sell them on it. Doug?
I think that, first of all, with regard to health care, I think one of the real problems for Obama with health care is the fact that it was done through reconciliation in a totally partisan way. And we've never had that happen before with any great advancement in an entitlement program where it's done totally on a partisan basis. And that's why he's faced with what he's got today with that. And that's too bad. I think what's missing in terms of an attribute right now, in terms of our leaders, is trust. If the public will trust the authenticity of the motives of the leader, they'll allow them to do things they otherwise wouldn't give them a right to do. The sign of a weak leader is where they have to kowtow to their base. When the president has to worry about his left wing, you know he's become weak, and that hurts our country. And so, because his base doesn't trust him anymore. So an effective politician generates some trust. And what FDR did, there are lots of folks who didn't like FDR's policies, but they trusted him that he was caring for them in a very, very difficult time. The Republican base trusted Ronald Reagan when he raised taxes in 1982 with Tip O'Neill because he told them it was a compromise, it was necessary to achieve their ideals, and they trusted that. Today we don't have a political leader that they trust.
You know, it's interesting, given that you ran Mitt Romney's Iowa campaign in 2008, that you bring that up. Isn't that part of what he faces?
I think so. I mean, one of the reasons why I didn't endorse Mitt Romney right away again is because there's a question of authenticity with him. When he came out here last time, he attempted to be a social conservative because he felt that it was politically advantageous for him to be social conservative when he really wasn't. And as a result of that, almost became a caricature of himself, in my opinion, from a political standpoint. Now, he's run a very different campaign this time, focusing on his core issues, the economic issues. But if you don't trust that politician is being authentic, true to their own beliefs, and those beliefs are central to yours, they're going to have a very difficult time leading.
I'd like to ask you in the audience, how do you know when you're watching an authentic politician? There were eyes rolling.
Have you seen an authentic politician?
Right.
I think our eyes are rolling because I think we have no idea how to recognize authenticity anymore, and I think that has slowly been eroded in so many ways, from trying to put school lessons together that we haven't really, speaking as a teacher, taught well or learned well, speaking as a student, that gets to Donna's point about poor citizenry. We have so much ignorance and lack of knowledge about basics, and then you flip that around with sound bites and that whole issue of you're just getting tiny little slices and you know you're not getting the whole thing and you have no idea. So I was in the room the other day when Mr. Gingrich was crying about his mom, and I looked at that and I lost my mom, and I feel pretty sensitive about that, and I had no idea whether or not that was really real. And that was the first thing I thought of was, is that real or isn't it real? What's going on here? That's a problem. And I think, Mr. Gross, that you've nailed it. There is so much lack of trust, and how we solve that, I don't know, other than better education, less sound bites, more, as I think you were saying, more opinion or more information context given by the press. That is very important.
You know, what you've said, I had the exact same reaction, and I thought it's because
Gosh,
I'm a
you guys
cynical.
Are cynical.
I was just going to say, it's because I'm a cynical reporter. It's very interesting to hear that you were in the room watching that one on one and still had the same reaction. I think Newt Gingrich would be appalled that there were people in the room questioning whether that was real.
And yes, and actually I'm a Democrat. I sort of grew up on a lot of things around Mr. Gingrich that I didn't think that I knew or respected, but the flip side to that is that I also think he's been mercilessly attacked with relentless funding that maybe isn't attached particularly so that we understand where it's coming from around these ads. Mm-hmm. And even I, who might not have been very sympathetic to Mr. Gingrich, has found myself going, now that's not fair, and that's corrupting our Iowa caucuses right there with this influence of huge, apparently huge dollars that are going into these ads. So I'm now kind of going over and going, no, wait a minute, how do we rectify that? Because it's not fair to the man either.
And that probably influences that question of authenticity with which you see any of the politicians. Tim, a quick comment on authenticity and the back out to the audience? How do we know it when we see it?
You know, I think that the problem is that we maybe have become too cynical for a variety of reasons, maybe too many politicians that have shed those crocodile tears so that we now question it when we see it. But, you know, I've seen enough of the, even though I haven't been in the room where obviously Gingrich or some of the others have done this, but I've seen a few instances such as the Thanksgiving Day forum that they had where a couple of the folks, Herman Cain and Rick Perry and Rick Santorum, each had a story that I felt was very moving. Now, maybe I would have felt differently if I had been in the room, but at least as it came across to me on the television, I thought, wow, that's a powerful story. This person is really laying it out there. And so I thought that was authentic. Now, whether other aspects of those candidates are less authentic, perhaps so, but I think there are at least times where you can sort of make that connection. But on the whole, you're probably right. It's maybe we've become too accustomed to being fooled and don't want to get fooled again.
One thing the public doesn't understand, and I don't know if they ever will understand, is that leadership is about service. It's about giving of oneself, not what you can take. And we've become so hardened by our politics and by the candidates that we see that we don't understand that.
Well, wait a minute. Is it that we don't understand it, or we don't believe that the politicians understand it?
Well, first of all, the greatest the likelihood of somebody winning, let me back up and talk about it this way. You remember Woody Allen's old line, 50% of life is just showing up? Well, and when it comes to running for president, a good share of who's going to win is dependent upon who wants it the most. And right now, Mitt Romney wants it the most of all the Republicans. You see Newt Gingrich today talking about the fact that his heart really was never in being president of the United States, because I think he sees himself in a different way, maybe even a bigger way. Who knows? But the point is, we set up a system of becoming president where if you want it bad enough, you'll go through this unbelievable gauntlet these folks go through. I mean, you ought to be with them for a day. It is incredible what these folks go through, and so as a result, they become hardened and self-centered. And as a result, they reflect that in their public appearances and the way that we look at them, when in fact the best leaders are those who serve us, not lead us, but lead us through service. We all know that, whether it's in our churches or in our families. And because of the nature of the political system, particularly the electoral system right now, I think we lose sight of that entirely.
Doug, it's interesting you mention that, because with the Newt Gingrich crying episode, In our newsroom, the general consensus was he was probably exhausted, and he probably had that moment of breaking down more than he normally would because he was exhausted.
No question, that's what happened.
Outside the people who run campaigns, our candidates who work, the next group of people that understand the pressure and the stress are the media, who are often in tow for all that time. So our newsroom thought, man, the guy's exhausted and he broke down.
Well, which doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't authentic, right?
And that's the thing. It was never a question
His
of
guard
whether it was authentic.
Down, right.
It was that it was a moment of reality that was probably caused by a grueling campaign.
And all too rare.
And anytime reality breaks through, it's a revealing moment. Particularly in the current system of running for president. And that's what you should look for as citizens. What do they do in those revealing moments, those moments that they don't anticipate, that they're too tired to think in this case? But that's where you really find the nature of their character and what they're really made of. And that's why people look at these debates and they become so important, because they're looking for one thing that they don't anticipate in the debates that are somehow going to reveal this person to them. I often think we'd be better off going back to the way it used to be, in running for president, where it is not such a long period of time, it is not so media-focused, it is a much shorter, compressed period of time where we get a chance to take their measure in a reasonable way, not in a way where the person who's likely to win is the person who frankly sacrificed the most in terms of being a reasonable person with their life.
Sir?
I just wanted to go back to the issue of leading people where they may not know they want to go. There are limits to that, because you could say that in the 2002, not many people in the United States thought that the United States needed to invade Iraq, and yet a very careful campaign was put together to convince enough people that that was necessary, and yet that's now viewed by most people as a great error. So aren't there limits to how far ahead of the populace you want to get and how much salesmanship can work?
I mean, I would argue in that situation, George W. Bush was a very effective leader. You just disagree with where he was leading you. But that doesn't mean he wasn't an effective leader. What he did there, very effectively, was created a common sense of a problem and an appropriate solution to it at the time. Now, we disagree with that, and your response to that is why the founders set up a system that doesn't allow for effective leaders very often, because effective leaders could just as easily lead us in the wrong direction as the right direction.
Sir, you wanted to add something to that in the middle?
Back to the issue of cynicism, I think, that looking back over, even the last, 20 years, it seems like there's been an inordinate amount of politicians on either side of the aisle who we thought we trusted, even if you didn't agree with them, who have disappointed us in major ways somehow or other and disappeared. And it seems like that has we only remember those, not the many others who have been steadfast and pretty much true to themselves and so on. And so that cynicism comes from that, I think. Here's another example of somebody just either playing to the public or giving an insincere apology for something that they felt they needed to do that for and so on. That, I think that cynicism has become almost the first thought, and sad that that's the case, but that really diminishes the chances for effective leadership because of that, that issue of trust. We don't know who we can trust anymore, so how can you identify someone who's authentic or not? I'm not sure it's possible.
That comment from the audience wrapped up last night's Town Hall Forum in Des Moines at the State Historical Building, a joint venture between Iowa Public Radio and Minnesota Public Radio. Complete Iowa 2012 caucus coverage starts tonight at 7 on Iowa Public Radio. Join host Ben Kiefer and Charity Nebbe, and a number of political analysts break down the night's results, and we'll have reaction from all of the candidates tonight at 7 here on Iowa Public Radio.